Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and in a few moments, you can listen to a comment by tablet correspondent in Rome, Robert Mickens, focusing on the apostolic exhortation Evangelii Gaudium issued by Pope Francis this past week. I'll then be moving to Berlin, where Stefan von Kempis, my colleague from the German desk, is currently reporting on the courtyard of the Gentiles. As a conference focusing on Bernard Lonergan's anthropology takes place here in Rome, I'll be bringing you an interview with Jesuit Professor Michael Paul Gallagher. Finally, to mark the first Sunday in Advent, Monsignor Philip Whitmore brings us a musical meditation. But first, as always at this time of week, I'm about to bring you a report on the weekly general audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world. For this, we join Philippa Hitchin.
Tens of thousands of pilgrims and visitors packed into St. Peter's Square on Wednesday morning, despite the near freezing temperature. Pope Francis, also wrapped up in a long white coat and scarf, reflected on the mystery of death, saying that without belief in God and a vision of life as something greater than earthly existence, death can seem like a tragedy that we misunderstand, fear, and deny. Without faith, the Pope said, death can seem scandalous, especially when children suffer and die. But as we know, when we lose a close friend or family member, our human hearts rebel against this false vision, and we yearn for the infinite, the eternal, the knowledge that life does not end with death.
Sale dal cuore la convinzione.
This yearning for life, the Pope continued, finds its answer in the resurrection of Christ, which offers both the certainty of eternal life and shows us the true meaning of death.
Questa sete di vita ha trovato la sua risposta reale e affidabile.
If we remain close to God in our lives, especially in solidarity with the poor and vulnerable, the Pope concluded, we need not fear death, but rather welcome it as the door to heaven and to the joy of eternal life.
La nostra morte diventerà una porta.
I'm Philippa Hitchin.
And while our thanks there go to Philippa Hitchin, this past week, on Tuesday, Pope Francis issued his first apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, translated into English as The Joy of the Gospel, a document in which the Pope shares with us his perception for a missionary church whose doors should always be open, in which he touches on a number of different themes, among them evangelization, peace, homiletics, social justice, the family, faith and politics, ecumenism, interreligious dialogue, the role of women and of the laity in the church, and of course, respect for creation. I asked the tablet's Rome correspondent and former colleague, Robert Mickens, to join me in studio to comment on the style and language of this document.
The whole kind of event of Pope Francis, what we've witnessed in the last 8-9 months, has been kind of encapsulated in this document, this apostolic exhortation. One of the things I like to tell people when they ask me about the Francis effect or, you know, what kind of pope is this, I like to point to or say he's a man of word and witness. And when I say word, this style of speaking, which we've come accustomed to.
The metaphors that people love.
The metaphors. I mean, it's a very direct, it's a simple, a warm kind of way of engaging people. It's heart to heart. As a matter of fact, in the apostolic exhortation, he talks a lot. He spends a lot of time on the homily during our liturgies and how very, very important the homily is. And he talks about speaking directly, briefly, heart-to-heart kind of conversation. And I think that's what he's been doing the entire pontificate with his Wednesday general audiences. He often leaves the text and engages his listeners in this vast crowd of listeners and directly engages them. He says, do you agree with me? And they
repeat those words.
They say it again. Okay, let's repeat it together. Let's stop a moment for silent prayer, and then we'll say a Hail Mary. I mean, a pope hasn't done this in so long. I think the last time that we had a brief look at this was John Paul I. And the older listeners will remember, and, you know, he only gave four, I think, Wednesday general audiences, but how surprised everyone was that first general audience when he called up a little boy, an altar server, and he used him as a way of demonstrating how God loves us. And he asked the little boy, when you're sick, what does your mother do? He says, I've never been sick. He says, oh, lucky
it
you.
Backfired. His question backfired.
But that kind of style, I think we haven't seen that directly. Of course, John Paul II was a master of the grand gesture and was kind of an icon. But Francis is very much engaging people one-on-one. Even in the square, when he moves around when they drive him around on the Jeep, he's looking at each individual person, so he's making contact with individuals rather than this vast throng of anonymous people. And that's very charming. So that's the word, but that also is the witness. I mean, I think right from the very evening that he stepped onto the balcony overlooking the square, we very quickly realized that he was the real deal. And his style of simplicity, his kind of sense of being so comfortable in his own skin, that's very compelling to people.
The royal we has gone out the window.
That's true. And it's when people say, well, did you see the latest document? The Pope said this. And I said, well, he says our pontificate and we. And I say, I suspect that he did not write that because, well, we know. I mean, popes can't write everything. And a lot of these very formal kind of letters and addresses, declarations and things, not of a doctrinal level, but of kind of a diplomatic stamp. These are written by other people in the name of the Pope, and they express his intentions. But when you see that style, we and our, you can pretty much guess that someone else wrote it for him.
We speak so much about communication. I'm sure he hasn't had any communications courses. He's a natural communicator, isn't he?
He's a natural pastor. And I think this is what we see in Pope Francis. This is a man who understands what it is to be a priest in the messiness of people's lives. Life isn't perfect. And I like the phrase when he said, when we put together our programs or our theology, we should not be doing it in a laboratory when we're working out our kind of pastoral plans and vision. But we need to do it at the grassroots with people. That's so very clear that this is a man who is much more comfortable being with people who need a kind word, who need encouragement, who don't have lives that are neatly put together, and for whom black and white answers aren't going to be the solution to their problem. So I think this is a man who really draws deeply from the gospel, which he very clearly prays over. You know, the morning homilies that he gives in the Santa Marta daily mass, these are incredible. They're all not written down, but they have been prepared earlier in the morning when he prays. That's very clear. He prays over the readings of the day, and he has this classic kind of formula, 3 points, usually, 3 quick points, and he leaves a very strong impression on people.
That's the Jesuit 3-point explanation, isn't it?
Yes, he's very much marked by his Jesuit formation. That's very clear. Discernment. You remember when he told us, I think, us from the media, quickly after his election, when he had the audience with us, he said he felt at peace. And I think that that is this kind of Jesuit consolation. When the Jesuits discern, there are lights and shadows, there's desolation and consolation. And Francis, I think, felt consolation. It's very clear. And at that moment, he stepped out of the Pauline chapel where he was praying before going to the balcony, and he was in some way transformed. Now, I don't want to make too much out of, you know, transformation, but I think he understood that he had a new mission, and he's embraced that with great gusto, surprising even many people in Argentina who have told me, you know, we've always loved him, but he's so gregarious now, and he's smiling and laughing a lot. We never saw that. And I think that's part of the mission that he's taken on. He realizes that his role as unifier, as the center of unity, as the successor of St. Peter, the bishop of this very important diocese in the life of the whole worldwide church, the primatial see, that his role is in some ways, not to beat people over the head, of course, but to in some ways be a cheerleader, to be someone who encourages, someone who helps people come together. He talks about unity a lot, and he talks about joy, and not only talks about it, but he demonstrates it. That's why I say,
that's
I go back
witness.
To this, word and witness. This man embodies it very, very beautifully.
And a big thank you there to Tablet's Rome correspondent, Robert Mickens. We'll be hearing from him again at this same time next week. Meanwhile,
the Courtyard of the Gentiles project, sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Culture, travelled to Berlin this week. The initiative stems from the call of Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, to the Roman Curia back in 2009 to draw inspiration from that courtyard, which was once part of the Jerusalem Temple. In his words, a free space for the Gentiles who wished to pray there to the one God, even if they could not take part in the mystery for whose service the inner part of the temple was reserved. Hence the inspiration for this initiative as a space of encounter and dialogue between believers and non-believers, one which has previously travelled to many other European capitals.
Stefan von Kempis is currently in Berlin following the event and spoke to Professor Hans Joas, a sociologist from Freiburg and a believer, who entered into debate with a professor of philosophy who is a non-believer. Professor Joas highlights how the initiative is a praiseworthy one.
First of all, I would say I welcome the initiative to enter into a dialogue between believers and non-believers, and particularly in an environment in which there clearly is a majority of non-Christians, and even among the Christians, a majority of non-Catholics.
In particular, in this respect, Professor Joas stresses his approval of the way the Catholic Church does not present itself as a sole possessor of truth, but is open to dialogue contributed by representatives of other orientations, although he also contests the wording of the metaphor of the initiative, highlighting how it is an opinion shared by many in Berlin, including in Catholic circles.
The metaphor that has been used for this initiative is considered to be somewhat problematical because and it may be against the intentions of the initiators. This metaphor, of course, still retains somehow the meaning of there is an inner circle of those who are in full possession of truth, and you are just admitted to the outer circles. And there is a certain tension between the attitude of saying, here we want a dialogue of equal partners, and using this metaphor. So that may be something that should be rethought a little bit.
That was German sociologist Professor Hans Joas. Meanwhile, moving back to Rome, an international conference focusing on revising Lonergan's anthropology took place at the Pontifical Gregorian University this week. Canadian Bernard Lonergan, who was born in 1904 and died in 1984, is a Jesuit most noted for his work on philosophical and theological method. Author of Insight, a Study in Human Understanding and Method in Theology, he taught at this university from 1953 to 1965. One of the speakers at this conference is fellow Jesuit, Father Michael Paul Gallagher, professor of theology at this same university, and his special contribution to this conference is a talk by the title of Lonergan, Therapy for Cultural Confusion. I went round to call on him earlier in the week. I'd like to begin by shedding a little light on a man who's considered to be one of the giants of 20th century theology, yet is little known by the wider public. In your opinion, why would someone considered to be such a giant be so little known?
Because he was such a specialist and chose to be a specialist for specialists. Just a curious fact, we may as well mention it. I discovered that he has the same birthday as Pope Francis, obviously a different year, but he was born on the same date, which is the 17th of December, in his case, 1904. Why is he so little known? Well, he's not that little known. He's little known by the big public, but there are three journals devoted exclusively to his work, And that is not true of any other theologian. So among perhaps a minority of people in the area of philosophy and theology, especially in Catholic circles, he is very well known.
When one speaks of Lonergan, the expression new foundation comes to mind. Can you explain?
Yes, he was a very conservative thinker. He spent many, many years studying Aquinas. He spent many years also in the Gregorian, teaching both Christology and Trinity, which are very central courses in dogma. And then he discovered gradually that the foundations weren't there anymore. The world had changed so much with science, with historical consciousness, and with many, many new questions, that he said, I have to rethink everything. So having had a very conservative or traditional foundation, because of his background in science, he felt he had to rethink the basis, especially of how do we arrive at truth for something that isn't scientifically verifiable. That's one example.
In terms of formation, then, you talk about his traditional approach. I mean, he relied on thinking of people like Augustine and Aquinas, so rolling back the clock to a world that no longer exists. Was this important in his formation, or was it rather Newman?
Well, he admired Augustine and Aquinas enormously for what they did in their time. But he was forever using the expression, let us be at the level of our own times. He wanted to do for today what Thomas Aquinas did for his day, when, of course, in Thomas Aquinas' time, there was this great mingling of Arabic thought and Aristotle and Christian thought and so on. So Lonergan wanted to do something of the same for the 20th century.
And Newman?
Newman was extremely important in awakening him to a different way of thinking. When he was only 24, he was studying in Heathrop, the old Heathrop in outside Oxford in England, studying philosophy. He was very bored with the kind of traditional philosophy in Latin that they were doing. And one day in the library, he came across The Grammar of Assent, which, by the way, is not the easiest introduction to Newman, not the easiest book to read. But he, Lonergan, young Canadian, read it 6 times and said, now this is for real. Here is someone who knows what they're talking about from inside. It wasn't just abstract. It wasn't just distant. It was personal, intelligent, and even dramatic.
Sort of psychological introspection.
Psychological would be one of Newman's words and one of Lonergan's words. Exactly. Yes. Yes.
What is his legacy today, do you think?
Well, his legacy today, if I want to put it almost personally, I would say he gives me intellectual consolation in the sense that I might be having a meeting with Professor Odifreddi, for instance, who Pope Benedict had dialogue with. And it's just possible he might come to one of my classes. There's talk about it because one of the students knows him. He can know everything about mathematics that I don't know. But I know where I stand and why I stand in a way that Lonergan has taught me to. He said, I want to introduce you to yourself. And he insisted always, don't just read my book, do it. It's a set of, almost like Ignatius, St. Ignatius had spiritual exercises, Lonergan has intellectual exercises. You get in touch with the operations, with the movements of your thinking. When you experience something, when you make a hypothesis about it and say, perhaps this is so. Above all, when you make a judgment. And how do you make a judgment? That was a big question for both Newman and Aquinas. And Lonergan, as it were, brings it up to date. And then, I shouldn't talk about him without mentioning his fiery social passion. He grew up in the time of the Depression. He saw a lot of economic suffering around him in Canada. And so he has this very strong social dimension of what is wrong with the world that so many people cannot have a decent life. So although he didn't do what theory of social justice as we know it today, in rethinking the foundations of where we are, how we arrive at truth, how above all we arrive at decisions, how faith changes us and transforms us, he's actually a very social thinker.
So he has a lot in common with Pope Francis. He's both a Jesuit and a social thinker in a sense, no?
I would think yes, especially this horizon behind their thought rooted in the experience of ordinary people, above all what he calls the suffering of history.
What is it that you find especially significant in Lonergan in terms of today's cultural context?
quilt.
That's a little bit the subject of your talk, isn't it?
Subject, yes. The title of my thought is Therapy for Cultural Confusion. I think we're confused about truth. I think if you really push, many people will be hard put to defend how they believe in God. Again, I think we're confused about all this stuff of objectivity and subjectivity. We can, and he was brilliantly clear on all this, having gone to the foundations. Again, I think we're very confused over how to read, we were talking about it a moment ago, the evil of history. What is the source of healing? Where Lonergan would see the whole of history, what he calls the dialectic of history in his jargon, as suffering from this swing, this pendulum, between we make a bit of progress and then we go into decline again, a bit of progress, decline. You can see this in the world of economics, in the world of culture, in so many words. He says, what we have forgotten is the third element, redemption. We have forgotten how to bring into our thinking about history, about where history is going, that God is active in this world through us. And how do you make the understanding of redemption socially fruitful? That would be an enormous question where I think we're very confused in our politics and in our sociology and so on and so on.
Would you like to add anything?
Yes. I think I would like to mention that one of his big discoveries, which sounds so simple, but it had been forgotten for centuries, he said to himself, now what is the real foundation, the real basis, foundation stone for theology? It is the fact that we are transformed by God's love. It is a religious experience. So he stopped talking about grace as a rather abstract world and word, and he started talking about religious falling in love. This is the foundation of theology. You don't do your theology just from books. You don't even just do it from the Bible or the tradition of the church. You do it by reflecting on what is basic in your own faith, in your own adventure as a believer, and then all the other things make sense.
You were listening there to Jesuit Professor Michael Paul Gallagher. Finally, I'd like to end on some musical notes to mark the first Sunday in Advent. That's with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
A generation or two ago, a very unpopular job among seminary students was ringing the bell first thing in the morning to get everyone out of bed. The reason it was unpopular, of course, was that it meant getting up even earlier, so as to be ready on time. At the start of Advent, we hear again and again the call to wake up, to get ready, to prepare ourselves for the day that is dawning. We all know how hard that can be if we're feeling sleepy. But we all know how necessary it is if we have something important to do. What could be more important than being ready to greet our Saviour when he comes? Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Awake, a voice is calling. That's the title of an old German hymn for Advent. The version we just heard was arranged by Michael Praetorius early in the 17th century, but probably more familiar to modern listeners is the arrangement made by J.S. Bach 100 years later. If any of you have worked with church choirs or liturgy planning groups, you'll know how hard it can be to prepare the music Sunday after Sunday for public worship. Imagine what it would be like if you had to compose the music as well. But that's exactly what J.S. Bach did for most of his life. He wrote his cantatas for use during the Sunday liturgy in Weimar and in Leipzig, often producing a new one each week. The cantata he wrote for the last Sunday of November in 1731 was Wachet auf, and he based a lot of the music on the tune we've been listening to. Now, I bet some of you are thinking, yes, it's lovely music, but it doesn't sound much like the tune we heard before. Wait for it. Bach is setting the scene with a beautiful counter-melody, preparing the way for the coming of the tune. Here it is, in long, slow notes in the voice parts. Listen now to a passage a bit later on, where Bach sets the second verse. Zion hears the watchmen singing. That's the counter melody. Now for the tune. Many people find the spiritual quality of Bach's music a great help with their prayer. It can settle us into a recollected frame of mind. If you get the chance, you may like to listen to a recording of Bach's cantata Wachet auf as part of your Advent devotion. At the heart of it is a dialogue between Christ and the soul. When the heavenly bridegroom comes, he invites the soul to join him at the wedding feast. No eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard such joy as this.
And warm thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently rector of the venerable English College here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.